technical reminders that I have for today's session. So again, we are here for the FRTR meeting at 30 years. And I want to be sure to turn it over here to Kent Glover. Again, Kent is with the U.S. Air Force Civil Engineer Center, and he serves as the FRTR Steering Committee Chair. So Kent, I'm going to call up your materials so that you can offer welcoming remarks to our audience. Kent?
Thank you. I want to welcome everyone to the FRTR Fall webinar and meeting. Last winter, when the steering committee began planning this meeting, we hoped for a full-day meeting face-to-face at the USGS headquarters in Reston, Virginia. But as you're well aware now, all that changed last March when the coronavirus situation unfolded. And so we pulled back our ambitions and our objectives to today, to a webinar today, and a set of objectives, which I've put on this slide. Is this works? Yes, there we go. So objectives for today are to provide a retrospective on 30 years of interagency collaboration, technology transfer, and advocacy by FRTR to advance technology innovation for site remediation. We want to highlight some current FRTR initiatives in technology transfer and applied innovative technologies that are contributing to successful site remediation. One of the other things we did about the time we had to go to a virtual setting was we decided we ought to do a fact sheet. And so we've prepared a fact sheet commemorating 30 years. And I've listed the title on this slide, slide number two. And you can get a copy of this, and I encourage everyone to do that by going to the Quilling website that you registered for this webinar on, and click the Related Links tab, and you'll see a link there for 30 years of FRTR, and you can download the PDF. I hope it is useful to everyone. I hope it gets widely distributed. We're kind of pleased with the way it turned out. Also, during the webinar today, there will be a couple of participant polls that will come up. I believe Gene will point these out to us, but I believe there they are. And they'll be up during some of the presentations. We'll pull them off later, and then they'll reappear later in this webinar. I want to encourage everyone to participate in these. Give us your thoughts. We want to take this information and help us chart a path forward into 2021 and years beyond that as well. So I just want to point that out. And I believe, Gene, I've lost my ability to see my screen. Or my presentation. I believe at this point that's about all I want to say except welcome. I hope you enjoy the webinar today. To kick things off for our first speaker, I want to introduce our first speaker. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Dan Powell. Dan leads the Technology Integration and Information Branch of the US EPA Superfund program, which promotes awareness and use of best practices and innovative technologies for environmental cleanup at hazardous waste sites. And he currently leads a number of, or supports a number of education and technology transfer initiatives. For example, implementing green remediation principles in Superfund, advancing innovative and state-of-the-practice techniques to optimize cleanup, advocating for sampling and analytical strategies to improve understanding and remedy performance, and just in general seeks to improve methods for delivering information and education to remediation professionals, both inside and outside the EPA. Dan's been with the EPA Technology Innovation Program really since 1990, and as such, he brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the challenges that are essentially the core mission of FRTR. Things like interagency collaboration, technology transfer, and advocating for the use of innovative technology in cleanups. 1990 also was the year that FRTR first stood up, 30 years ago now. And that makes Dan one of the few FRTR pioneers still working at a federal agency that I'm aware of, at least. And it's through his continuing involvement that he has come to personify, really, within FRTR, our organizational memory. We continue to benefit greatly, I think, from his unique perspective, his knowledge, and his continuing ongoing interest. So as I said at the start of this introduction, it's my great pleasure to introduce Dan Powell as our first speaker today. It really is. Dan's going to talk with us a bit about FRTR retrospective, the benefit of FRTR to agency mission. So welcome, Dan.
Oh, thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate the introduction and the kind words. Kind of makes me feel a bit old there when you start hearing it spoken out, laid out that way. Yeah. But it's been a great honor to be involved in this organization, in this this forum for such a long period of time, and just all the great people that have participated in the meetings and been members of the round table. Again, the collective knowledge has been a real value, and it just like I said, an honor to me to be part of, and I appreciate the opportunity to do this. So what I'd like to do today is just really kind of go through this concept of, you know, what the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable looks like at 30, and to kind of to give a feel for that, I wanted to go back and give a retrospective look at where we started and how we progressed over the, you know, first 20, 25 or so years, give some perspective on where we are currently and what we've been recently looking at, and then to really give some momentum to some thought and discussion about where we need to go or where we should be going. So that being said, we're going to go ahead and move through this a little bit, and just to give an idea of Federal Roundtable, where it started. Initially in May of 1990, it was about the time that EPA created a Technology Innovation Office, and the idea behind the Technology Innovation Office was to advocate for the use of innovative technologies, primarily for treatment at that time, but really be that advocate across the waste cleanup community as a whole, which not only included not only EPA, but the federal agencies who are doing site cleanup, the private sector doing site cleanup, the consultants doing the work, the state regulators and other stakeholders, the tribes and other stakeholders who were involved, and to be that one voice for innovation. And one of the first areas of business was to really bring together and try to leverage the knowledge and expertise across the federal government. And so in May of 1990, it started as a meeting of senior executive level program managers with the agencies who were involved in both cleaning up sites, but also had significant technology development demonstration programs. We started with that welcome introduction that most people want to hear, which is we're from EPA and we're here to help you. It took a little bit to get the relationships moving forward. So at that point, most of the interactions between EPA and the other federal agencies in this hazardous waste Superfund cleanup area was primarily enforcement related, primarily adversarial. So how do we move forward, start to collaborate? So what we did is we started small, really just started jointly documenting information resources that we each had on innovative technologies, trying to leverage that knowledge and get that out there, and really document and share information on technology demonstrations. And what we're trying to do is build some momentum to make this a longer standing process. And, you know, in parallel, where were we with technologies in 1990? At that point, we defined innovative treatment technologies as technologies whose routine use is inhibited by the lack of data on cost and performance. You know, what was driving that? We had the amendments to Superfund, Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, which really created a preference to move away from dig and haul type remedies and capping remedies and look towards more permanence, look towards more treatment, and look towards alternative technologies. Similarly, the hazardous waste regulations were putting land disposal restrictions in place, which led to a push towards in-place or in-situ treatment. And really, as I'll show in just a minute, we have a very limited menu of treatment options at this site, because really this was a new area of scientific endeavor. When you think about it, you know, Wright Brothers, turn of the century, you know, rocket science and NASA, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, whatever, we had really just started looking at this whole hazardous waste site cleanup area on a very large scale in 1980. So it was a very new area of science and a very new scientific endeavor, and we were working from there. The starting point, you know, and again, just to give an idea of why we're, you know, what we were looking at that point in time, I figure out, I apologize for this. It seems to be. Having a mind of its own here. You know, the starting point was we were, you know, really looking at a place where most of the soil remedies, the remedies for dealing with surface soils and that were mostly just the capping or dig and haul type remedies. You can see that roughly 75% of those. And then for groundwater, we were primarily looking at pump and treat remedies. Over 95% of the remedies we were looking at were pump and treat. And so at that point in time, there was very little, very few options available. For site characterization, what were we looking at? We were primarily looking at monitoring wells, laboratory offsite analysis. And information on the fate and transport was the contaminants in the subsurface was really, we were just starting to understand how that was working. There was very limited understanding at that point in time. In terms of R&D programs and R&D, research, development, demonstration, there were a large number of options out there. A lot of programs were created in the late 1980s. The Superfund Innovative Technology Evaluation Program, a site program run through our Office of Research and Development, was just getting underway and very active. Both the Departments of Defense and Department of Energy had very well-financed, well-funded research, development, demonstration programs. And at the state level, there was significant activity. States like California, for example, had their own technology evaluation program, as did international groups like Environment Canada. There are also a number of nonprofit or private sector entities looking at technology innovation for waste site treatment. The Northeast Technology Application Center, the Petroleum Environmental Research Forum, all looking at innovation. So there was a lot of RD&D activity going on, but still we didn't have a lot of information on cost and performance of how these technologies actually operated in the real world. Looking in the 1990s, what were we starting to look at? We're looking at treatment technologies, you know, soil treatment, you know, surface soils, vadostone type treatment, groundwater treatment, as I said, very limited options. Characterization, people really weren't focusing on characterization at that point in time. Obviously, it was important. We were doing a lot of investigation, but innovation in that area wasn't, you know, people were really focusing on kind of the big dollar, actually, when you're in the field and starting to clean up. And there was actually a lot of push at that time to move past the investigation stages and just start doing work. You know, bioremediation was just getting underway. I mean, folks may remember, you know, 1990, the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened. And that was the first time where people really saw bioremediation in the national news. They were showing how they were using the microbes to clean up the beaches in Alaska. And in terms of ex situ treatments, a number of options were out there, but just getting underway. And again, very limited information on cost and performance, but there were still treatment options ex situ at that point in time. You know, the round table, what did we do with that in the 1990s, early 1990s? You know, first order of business was really to try to put our heads together. And as we were starting to apply these technologies, either a full-scale demonstration phase or in the field, bring that information together. So the roundtable developed a framework or a template for reporting cost and performance based on the types of technologies that were out there. You know, all in all, trying to provide better information for the decision makers. Information exchange was a very big part of what we were doing too. You know, just trying to get that information back and forth. The meetings really transitioned from these senior executive levels. Meetings to kind of what they are today, where we focused on specific topics and all the agencies got together and brought their experts together to share what they knew on those specific topics. We used the roundtable as a jumping off point for a number of public-private partnerships, working with the large companies who also had significant sites to clean up. You know, both through our Remediation Technology Development Forum, there was an effort working with clean sites at that point in time. To test technologies at federal sites. And then, you know, DOD had their National Environmental Test Site program, too. So a lot of work was being done, you know, partnering with private industry to kind of look at what we were doing and then also leverage that investment. Again, at that point in time, we had a big focus on remediation. There wasn't a lot of attention being paid to alternatives and approaches to characterization. It wasn't until the late 1990s that we really started looking at field analytical tools and better strategies for using those tools in the field. Came under the rubric of the triad approach, et cetera, but that was, you know, really more towards the late 1990s. And the other piece, too, that kind of changed the game for us a little bit, and this may seem like a long, long time ago, but it really wasn't. But, you know, the actual use of the Internet to do training and trade information, you know, early in the 1990s, we were using electronic bulletin boards, and not a lot was being done. You know, a lot of paper documents, a lot of mailings, a lot of conferences where you handed out paper documents. And the Internet really, you know, started to come into play as a key mechanism for us to exchange information. So what happened? Between the mid-1990s, we started to shift away from, looking at individual technology and start to think about concepts of things like combined remedies, treatment train type scenarios. In addition, we also started looking at, instead of, again, individual technologies, platforms for delivering either for characterization technologies where you're combining multiple tools into a single platform or delivery mechanisms for treating technologies in situ, you know, a lot of attention was being paid in that area too. The concept of green remediation was actually occurring as well. We were focusing a lot on, you know, how can we create a subgroup in the roundtable, how can we minimize our impacts, environmental footprint of our cleanup activities, you know, both in terms of, impacts in the environment, the energy used, kind of minimizing the use of raw materials, et cetera. So that whole concept of green remediation came into play as well. So a lot of work there, and then, you know, other emerging concepts were occurring as well, which were, triad approach, remedy optimization. You know, by the late 1990s, we had significant emphasis on, a number of pump and treat systems in place and things like that, so we started to look, how can we optimize those? Land revitalization became much more of an area, and then we really moved greatly ahead in building that library of cost and performance case studies. On the other hand, you know, towards the end of the 1990s, we started to see the money for research and development demonstration shrinking at the federal level. So, you know, kind of leveraging our knowledge became more key. Okay. Again, so that kind of gives you a sense as to where we were. And if we remember kind of the the original slides I had up showing, you know, this was the most recent Superfund remedy report that we just recently put out. We had a just came out and looks at remedies 2015 to 2017. Where are we right now? Well, number one, you see there was a big shift towards the use of treatment technologies, particularly in situ treatment technologies. You can see a lot of the things that we were talking about early on, chemical treatment, thermal treatment, vapor extraction, you know, a lot of different tools like that became much more commonly used at sites, and treatment as a whole became much more commonly used. And even places where we're using containment, there are a lot of improvements in the technologies and the tools at that point in time as well. We started looking at things like vegetative caps, you know, and ways to improve that, better leachate collection, better monitoring, et cetera. So great improvement in those areas as well. In terms of groundwater treatment, you can see that there was, what's happened since that time. You know, you look at the early 1990s, I mentioned, you know, 95% plus of our sites were pump and treat. And you can see what's happened over time from our remedy report looking at this data. That trend line for pump and treat, the red line itself, a significant decrease, started moving, you know, trending downwards, while the trend for in situ or other sorts of alternative treatments started to increase markedly. You saw the application of monitored natural attenuation and a much greater use, you know, of in situ controls, or much more consistent use of in situ controls or institutional controls at our sites. And then, you know, kind of where are we now in terms of the pump and treat piece? You know, at this point right now, at the sites where pump and treat is selected, 91% of those sites have other remedies also in place. So where we're just solely selecting pump and treat for containment and treatment, that number of sites is decreased markedly over that time period. And this gives you an idea, you know, what are some of those technologies that have become much more commonly used? And again, this is information in our Superfund remedy report. We just recently published. It looks at remedies selected between 2015 and 2017. Again, the large number of, whether it's in situ treatment, using bio, using chemical treatment, thermal treatment, it's just a very active toolbox of sites, technologies that are being selected at our sites. And the one point, too, is, you know, what we started to look at for groundwater treatment, it's not as many new technologies coming onto the scene, but we're really kind of focusing on improvements, you know, things like in terms of our strategies, optimizing the sites and using those lessons learned, looking at using combined remedies, looking at taking adaptive approaches to, apply multiple remedies as you move through the life cycle of the site, you know, much better use of the data that's available as well at these particular sites too. In the last 5 years, what have we been looking at in terms of the roundtable? Again, I mentioned before, you know, land reuse idea of reusing, you know, getting land back into productive reuse, looking at the materials that are coming from the site. You know, that's an area we've been looking at. Understand the importance of site characterization. You know, a lot of the work looking at understanding the geology of the subsurface, understanding, the fate and transport of contaminants and how that impacts the performance of remedies and doing a better job there. And then really kind of maximizing the use of data as well. You know, a lot of these sites, there's a considerable amount of data collected on these projects, and how can we best leverage that data through life cycle conceptual site models to understand what's happening at the site. You know, I mentioned remedy optimization, that the process is continuing. You know, started in 1997. Within our Superfund program, we did anywhere from, you know, 4 to 6 sites per year. Now we're at a place where we're, you know, starting anywhere from 15 to 20 new optimizations per year. We've done close to 400 in total. That's a big area, and it's an area the roundtable has looked at, as all the agencies within the roundtable have done a considerable amount of work there. big sites, whether it's mining or sediment sites. You know, that's another area of focus, an area of interest for technology innovation, an area where the roundtables will continue to look at. Maximizing the responsible use of models. We had a meeting a couple sessions ago where we really looked at, you know, understanding the use of models, maximizing the use of models to support decisions, not to make decisions, but then, you know, understand what's going into the models, what you need to do, and increase our joint understanding of you know, the assumptions that are there, what they're useful for, what some of the limitations are. And one of the recent projects you'll see in the fact sheet is, you know, we had a bibliography and of agency resources on models. And then again, we're dealing with emerging issues. And I'll mention this in just a little bit, but, you know, the idea of resiliency of the remedy is holding up to perhaps changes in, you know, severe weather conditions, you know, any sort of climatic changes that might be occurring. You know, how resilient are these long-term remedies to dealing with that? And we've looked at that as a whole. And then also looking at emerging contaminant issues we might be facing, like PFAS. So, you know, in terms of perspective, you know, what's the roundtable? What has been the impact? You know, have we led the charge on any of these technologies or anything? I think the idea is that the roundtable has really kind of moved the concept of innovation, you know, moved that dialogue forward and really kind of created an atmosphere of action among decision makers where, again, we're leveraging and we're sharing and we're using our shared expertise to move things forward and also inform the users of the technologies, whether they be in the federal family or not. A lot of work there. You know, again, the innovation and the roundtable work has really focused on, you know, that leveraging of knowledge and experience. You know, two great examples, you know, I'll just throw out there is, you know, the concept of direct push technology. It's been a great platform for a variety of fronts, whether it's for sampling or doing analytics or applying sensors, et cetera. But I remember early on, we were, you know, had the Corps of Engineers in the Navy came in talking about their cone penetrometer systems and how they were being used. You know, again, at that point, a lot of focus on using drill rigs and traditional sampling tools and techniques and really kind of advancing the advantages of direct push tools and the growth there has happened. And a lot of that work happened early on based on the research and development and use activities of the federal agencies, and we shared a lot of that knowledge across the roundtable. You know, thermal treatment's another area. I can remember early on, you know, Superfund research programs, you know, funding going out to look at some of the very early uses of in-situ thermal treatment, Department of Energy testing out, you know, steam injection, electrical resistivity heating, you know, at some of their sites, and then really kind of sharing that information and moving it forward and, you know, some of those initial applications. Again, the cooperation and collaborative spirit is there. I think we've moved past that kind of wary. We've had, you know, over the years, we have our differences, but we still continue to cooperate and collaborate, and the fact that we're still continuing to meet, you know, semi-annually, even in the face of a pandemic, and sharing information is still an area of interest and really haven't gotten stale over the years, I think has been a real plus. And we're also expanding membership over, you know, the last 5 or so years. The National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences came on. We have a very active Superfund research program. We want to make sure we're continuing to understand what's on the horizon in terms of research. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's become very active, and, you know, we hear a couple of folks from NRC speak today, but very active members of the roundtable. We've, you know, pushed us in new directions, whether it's looking at heavy metals or metal sites, radionuclides, things like that. Again, a lot of work there too. And, you know, continuing that education element as well. And I think all in all, you know, one of the advantages of the roundtable is kind of really pushing that atmosphere of innovation at federal sites, because those federal markers are still large. And I think, you know, that will help drive practice because of the size of the markets for cleanup tools and technologies. So why does this continue to be important? You know, this is traditionally, we look at technology innovation. It's almost a linear process when you move from basic research through, you know, bench to field to pilot testing until you get to that full-scale field use. And really, it's not as much a linear process as one that continues to evolve. And as you move through those various stages and you learn what some of the limitations are, what some of the issues are through that experience, it's like what some of the needs of the technology users are once you start to scale up, you're continually feeding that research to, you know, go back and adjust and tweak and get it to the point where it's much more ready to use. And then, you know, the research community needs to continue to respond, modify those tools, optimize, move forward, so we do get to a point where we have technologies that are ready to work at, you know, not just one site, but a number of sites. So, again, a group like the Roundtable and these types of interactions allow for that sort of information exchange and sharing of knowledge and sharing of expertise. And, you know, one of the things I did mention that some of the funding and some of the aspects of advancing innovation, this is a, has declined over the years, so even more important, you know, as the technology moves from the bench to the pilot to the actual commercial development and starts to experience, you know, you start to have to engineer the technology to fit real site conditions and address the hard realities of the site, you know, the costs of that go up. And, you know, having this kind of joint sort of process where we're leveraging and knowledge and experience rather than having one single entity responsible for meeting that cost has been something that you know, it maintains a very essential role for a group like the Roundtable and other sorts of collaborative enterprises. So where are we moving forward? You know, what are some of the areas to look at? You know, one of the areas is, you know, high-resolution site characterization. You know, again, understanding at a micro scale what's happening in the subsurface greatly impacts the performance of the remedies and looking at those long term. You know, I mentioned our optimization report. You know, probably two-thirds of the sites we look at, there's some area, you know, further characterization is needed to improve the performance of the remedies. So this high resolution characterization will continue to be an area we want to take a look at. As I mentioned before, you know, making sure that these long-term remedies are resilient in terms of, you know, weather impacts, in terms of changing populations, patterns and things like that. And you want to make sure that, so areas that we want to continue to look at is how we can make our remedies more resilient. I mentioned, you know, addressing the complexity of these large sites, maybe not on the site scale, but the pieces within that site. You know, what can we do to address these larger sites? Continue the mining sites continue to be an issue that we're looking for innovation in. And again, helping to move the research to commercialization. Another area, PFAS has taken over. You're trying to figure out how to characterize and analyze for the PFAS compounds, but also how to dispose or treat. You know, will continue to be a area that we want to take a look at. And I mentioned materials reuse. You know, there's been a lot of guides, executive order on, you know, critical the use of making sure that we have a supply of critical minerals. You know, is this something that is a roundtable we can look at where this might occur at some of our sites and something we want to take a look at. But all in all, I think, you know, this concept of advancing innovation is something we really want to continue to do, kind of maintain that communication, kind of continue to leverage those investments is very important to us. And then, you know, where we want to do is refocus. You know, I think one of the areas that we need to do a better job at the federal level is be very specific in what our needs are, you know, beyond that simple contaminant versus, you know, media. You know, it's clearly stating what that need is, what are the performance metrics, you know, what are the users of the technology really need, and communicating that to the research community. And then kind of map out that path forward and really work to see how we're going to move, you know, not just the, you know, research level technologies, but improvements on the existing technologies, moving those forward. Bottom line, you know, with the continuing need, I mean, technology is continuing to evolve. The need for innovative technologies is continuing to happen, both in terms of the problems and the size of the problems we're dealing with, but also the emerging issues that we're facing. You know, I think a body like the Roundtable is going to continue to have a role. And With that, I'm going to go ahead and just wrap up. I apologize for somehow seemed to have a little bit of a delay here on my internet, and it kept popping through slides, so I apologize for some of those difficulties, but I'll turn it back for some questions now.
All right. Thank you so very much, Dan. I just wanted to remind the audience they can send questions and comments in for our presenters at any time using that Q&A window in the lower corner of their screen. I do see one question that came in, Dan, and I'm not sure if you can answer this one, but I'm just going to read it out loud to you before we move on. One of the attendees wanted to know, what role do you see technical impracticability, or the TI waivers, playing in addressing complex sites in large diffuse groundwater plume sites?
Well, again, there's a lot of, EPA does have existing guidance on the use of technical impracticability waivers. It is a tool in the toolbox, and we have used technical impracticability waivers at the at sites. I believe some more recent data, a large number of those are close to 100 or over 100 in the history of the program. So it is something that we continue to take a look at, and it's just, it's one tool. And again, that's up to the individual, working at the individual site level to kind of address the specific issues at that site. But it is, something that can be handled with the regulators at the specific site.
All right. Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate that. I think in the interest of time, we're going to move on to our next presentation, but I do see some additional questions that came into the queue. So, Dan, I'm going to ask you to stay with us until the end, and as time permits, we may circle back to you later on, okay?
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks. So the next speaker on our agenda is Mike Adam. Mike is joining us from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where he's serving as a point of contact on various issues and initiatives, such as vapor intrusion, decision support tools, and measurement and monitoring technologies for the 21st Century Initiative. He's also part of the CLUIN management team. You may have heard him moderate a number of webinars as well. So, Mike, I wanted to invite you to come off of mute, and feel free to begin your presentation whenever you're ready.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can.
Thanks, Jean. That's an old biography, but it still mostly applies. So today I was going to talk a little bit. I know today we're kind of doing a retrospective, but we've been doing some work on the web presence for the FRTR, which is at frtr.gov. I did have a quick summary here. Most of this discussion is going to be about the new technology matrix that we recently completed. And the FRTR, we had an FRTR web subgroup, and it was convened to update FRTR. I don't remember exactly when this was. I wasn't in initially, but I believe that was in early 2015. And a short time later, the work group decided to focus on the remediation technology screening matrix, which we'll get to in a second. And right now, additional things. We have a new subgroup that is working on updating the remediation optimization resources. And we also have recently added a new bibliography, which is available under the current publications section. And I'm not going to talk about that because that Tom is going to discuss that in a few minutes. So the remediation technology screening matrix is available at frtr.gov. It's under the technology screening matrix tab. There's a disclaimer on the old matrix that it's been replaced, but as of right now, if for whatever reason you still want to look at the old matrix, it is still available. So to get to the new version, you can click on the new version hyperlink that was on this previous page. See the updated link there, the new version. It's in red under the red banner there. Or you can go directly to frtr.gov/matrix. The matrix, as you might notice, is in a new format that conforms to the U.S. Web Design System. And fortunately or unfortunately, there's
Thank you. You will now be placed into conference. The leader has muted all lines. You will now be joined to the conference muted. To unmute your line, press #6.
Another way of describing the commercial status of it. And effectiveness across multiple chemical classes. So the matrix may be, you know, you can use a basic search to search through the profiles to look for specific profiles. Right now, this is an example of what the search on all profiles looks like. It'll give you a list of the 49 profiles that we have in the new matrix. And for just a quick, we're going to walk through a quick example of one of the profiles. Show you what's in each of them. So here, what we have at the top of the page, we have links for internal navigation, and we also provided a formatted PDF if you wish to download or share the profile. It's not exactly the same as the page formatting, but it it should be a higher quality way to view, share, and print the profile if someone wished to do so. So there's a basic schematic, a basic introduction. We provide, you know, listings of other technology names, a general discussion or a general description of the technology, and we walk through things like development status, as I mentioned, and we have a discussion on applicability, and what you see here, this is sort of a summary for each technology that you also would see in the actual profile on or the actual listing within the matrix. We spent considerable time talking or thinking through about how we wanted to discuss costs. In the cost section in the profile, we discussed the general relative costs and where the technology generally falls on the spectrum, as well as considerations that could affect costs. And rather than include, you know, a general cost discussion within each profile to shorten it, we provided that discussion separately, and each profile has a link to that more general cost discussion. The profile is finished with sections discussing the things like the expected duration required for remediation, additional implementation considerations, and then also a resources list. As I'd mentioned, the matrix consists of 49 profiles. That's considerably fewer than the old matrix. There was some consolidation, and there was a few that were dropped because they're, relatively speaking, they weren't, you know, as, you know, relevant as, you know, they weren't directly relevant to remediation. And some of them appear as in specific consolidated profiles, such as the vapor treatment technologies profile. We also have water treatment technologies profile, and those would be treatment works, like in a treatment facility. And then there's some other profiles that we decided to combine for efficiency. Additionally, so that sort of ends the discussion on the new matrix. What you can find on FRTR.gov is meeting and events archives. What we have there are the information for upcoming meetings and recent meetings, as well as a link over to FRTR Presents or our recent meetings that, you know, we have used the online platform for, and those take you over to CLUIN. And here's just a schematic that shows you how, once you get to the training and events page, if you go there, you can search the archives, and if you specifically want the FRTR Presents and FRTR related presentations, you simply can search for FRTR, and it'll bring up the entire list of FRTR events. Additionally, we have hundreds of other events that we've recorded related to remediation and characterization, you know, at various levels on the innovation spectrum. We've been recording those for 2 decades, and all of those are, or most of those are available here. In addition, ITRC and Superfund Research Program has we have their archives on here as well. Just one quick look, we're also moving CLUIN over to the new U.S. Web Design System Standard, and you can look forward to that soon. So don't freak out when you see that instead of some of the screenshots that I've shown. I think that ends the content that I had. So if there are any questions.
Sure. Mike, we did have a few questions about the matrix, and people were mm-hmm. just wondering if they have information that could be included in that matrix, can they reach out to you?
Sure. And so what we would do there is we would convene the web subgroup and discuss the updates, potential updates or whatever that might be. Yeah, sure. It's an online document. It can be, you know, as resources allow, you know, it's kind of a living thing.
Okay.
So the answer is yes. Sorry.
Sure. And sort of related to that, when you're listing technologies, is there a vetting process when a commercial entity or a vendor may claim that their technology has certain capabilities?
I probably not in the way that the person who asked the question means. Probably I would say no. So it would be the same type of thing where we would use, you know, the subjective judgment of the experts that we reached out to within our organizations to provide information. That doesn't mean that if somebody has information that is, you know, because we like to talk about things as technologies and not, you know, products of a specific vendor. But if somebody has information, we you know, be willing to look at that. I would not make any promises that we would specifically add something. It just would have to go through a process. It's not necessarily a formal process, but again, it would involve reconvening the web subgroup and having agencies look at it.
All right, thanks. Well, I don't see any other questions here in the queue for you at this time. So I think what we'll do is just move on to our next presenter. So I'm going to call up the presentation here. I want to thank Mike for sharing his expertise. And I'll go ahead and introduce our next speaker. speaker. So next we're going to be joined by Tom Nicholson, who's with the USNRC. Tom is a senior technical advisor for the radionuclide transport in the Environment Division of Risk Analysis at the Office of Nuclear Regulatory Research. And he also serves as the NRC representative on the FRTR Steering Committee. So, Tom, at this time, I welcome you to come off of mute and start in with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Jean. And I especially want to thank Kent Glover, who's been our chair for the last 2 years of FRTR. And I want to also thank Dan Powell and Mike Adam for the nice references to the bibliography. So can you hear me okay, Jean?
Yes, we can.
Okay. The activity we're going to talk about, the bibliography, came about because at a previous FRTR meeting on May 22nd, we had a special meeting focusing on modeling and support of site remediation, and a question was raised during the panel discussion as to the availability of guidance on subsurface modeling and support of site remediation. And no one seemed to really have a clear answer, and so a motion was made to form an ad hoc subcommittee to identify the guidance, if it exists. And it was the motion was seconded, and we went forward. So the FRTR, Kent Glover, asked the members of the steering committee to provide a list of guidance documents and information sources to assist practitioners on... if you go to the next one, Jean, my computer, okay, there you go, thank you. So Kent Glover requested the steering committee members to go through their information sources and guidance documents and to report them back to the ad hoc committee. And surprisingly, there weren't any clear answers, and so therefore, the ad hoc committee, which consisted of myself and Kent Glover as the co-chairs, and we had a representative from EPA, Noman Asun Usman, and George Alexander from the NRC, and John Fenske from the Army Corps of Engineers, and Ed Gilbert from EPA, and Tom Lancaster from NRC, and Sophia Lee from the Navy, and Alan Shapiro from the USGS, and Elise Stritz from also from the NRC, and DOE, Paul Beam nominated Haruko Wainwright from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory to be on the committee. So since there was, next slide, please. And go to the next one, please. So there was no single answer, no single guidance document to help identify groundwater modeling in support of remediation. The ad hoc members expanded their search to look at groundwater flow and transport in both the unsaturated and saturated zone and contaminant transport. And because of this expanded search, there were many, many information sources identified. And so in order to organize it, we decided to have two topical areas and to also partition the information sources into cross-cutting categories. And Sophia Lee was kind enough to identify definitions of those topical areas, and we also came up with the similar cross-cutting categories. Next slide, please. Next, thank you. So the topical areas, we decided in order to organize all these information sources and guidance documents, to make it easy for people to query the system, we created acronyms. And so there are many acronyms and cross-cutting areas as well. So under the topical areas, we decided to organize the documents according to whether it's general guidance or characterizations to support development of conceptual site models, numerical models in their manuals and output portrayals, the QAQC, the data and the model inputs. Important topic area was calibration, verification, and validation of the models, uncertainty analysis of the models, and then finally, case studies of modeling which supports remediation decisions. Next slide, please. So the cross-cutting categories was the guidance and information sources of a regulatory and industrial guidance, such as ASTM. And under regulatory, it was both federal, EPA, NRC, whatever, and then also states, state of California and Ohio had some guidance. And then the second cross-cutting category was the guidance on modeling tools, manuals, and output portrayals? Was it lessons learned from modeling case studies which focused on remediation successes? And then the two categories of subsurface flow and modeling, both for the saturated and unsaturated zone, and then contaminant transport. Next slide, please. So what we did was, we decided, obviously, to organize a detailed bibliography using those two categories and publish these, and it was reviewed and approved by the steering committee, and we agreed to put it on the FRTR website under current publications. So each citation identifies its author, the document title and reference information, abstract, scope, electronic link, and topic on cross-cutting acronyms. So we have an example. Next slide, please. So here's an example of a citation in the bibliography. This was one of the better ones we found that really helps people a lot. It was the Australian Groundwater Modeling Guidelines by Barnett and Townley. And we give you the link to go find it. And we also give you the ISBN number and information. And then if you look underneath, we have two in black. We have the topical areas. This is this citation is general guidance. It discusses calibration, verification, and validation of models. And it also addresses uncertainty analysis of models. And that's in black. And then to the right, in green, is the cross-cutting categories. So since this is from the Australian government, it is a regulatory and industry guidance. It also discusses subsurface flow and modeling, and then also discusses contaminant transport modeling. And then, as you see below, there's a guidance, an abstract and scope, which helps the reader understand how this may be a benefit to them. Next slide, please. So, if you go to the CLUIN site that you're at right now, you can actually see the bibliography is posted there. You can go to it. We also provide a link to it. The FRTR steering committee that's agreed to this bibliography is actively looking for your feedback on its usefulness. Does the bibliography help you? If so, how does it help you? And also request if you have additional information on developed guidance that we missed, we didn't site, we'd like you to provide that to us. We've agreed that this bibliography will be updated on a 5-year basis. So that's all I have to report on. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so very much. So I will just continue to remind everyone, you'll find these types of resources on the middle right under related URLs, and I'll also be popping them right into that Q&A website. Or pardon me, Q&A window, you can use that to access these references as they're dialogued and talked about today. And for those of you looking for copies of the presentation materials, we have already posted those to download from the seminar slides tab on the seminar homepage that you would have used when checking in today. So Tom, we wanted to thank you for your presentation. I'll just ask if the audience has any questions, please be sure to put them in now. If you don't, you can also put in no questions and send that message into the Q&A right now, just so that we know that there aren't any questions I'm waiting to receive, and we can move on to our next speaker. So I'm going to pause here for just a moment and remind the audience, again, that Q&A window is open throughout the whole session, and you don't have to wait for a Q&A break. You can send your questions in at any point. But we did get a question, Tom, that came in quickly. Someone wanted to know if you were updating the bibliography or what the schedule of updates might be.
Yes, we are going to update the bibliography. I think if we get some response back, we'll do it probably within the next year. But we've agreed that it will be a 5-year basis that we're going to be updating the bibliography. So the bibliography, if people have input to it, please give it back. We're looking for feedback on its usefulness and also if we've missed any guidance documents or information sources. As I said before, we ask all the member agencies to give us their information, and we got quite a bit from EPA and from USGS and DOE and others. And then we also were looking at the National Groundwater Association. We found information from them. We found it from the state of Ohio and the state of California. And, of course, we have ASTM standards as well. So if you have information on guidance documents and information sources, please send it to me, and we'll update it. Thank you very much.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much, Tom. We had just a couple of people who have noted that they're interested in looking at this, so thanks for sharing information about it. I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and move right on to our next presentation. So our next speaker will be Dr. Bobby Abu-Eid, and Dr. Eid is a senior level or SLS advisor at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He provides high-level advice on technical and policy issues involving decommissioning, uranium recovery, low-level waste, and environmental protection. He's a member of the Multi-Agency Radiation Survey and the Site Investigation Manual, or MARSIM, work group, and the NRC's lead representative on the Multi-Agency Radiological Laboratory Analytical Protocols, or MARLAP. So I'll invite Bobby to come off of mute and begin his presentation when he's ready.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for your participation. Thank you, Jean. Thank all the organizers for FRTR seminar. It's really good. We are involved in that because it is very interesting that to follow up regarding the technology for remediation. NRC is interested in radiation radioactivity that's available in the environment for remediation for multiple reasons, for our decommissioning activities as well as uranium recovery activity. So the presentation today, I will be talking about the Multi-Agency Radiological Survey and Site Investigation Manual and the approaches and the issues focusing on subsurface and what are the potential new technology that can be used in survey and characterization. Before I start, I would like to acknowledge my co-authors by name, Mark Furman, Cynthia Barr, and Tom Nicholson from NRC. More importantly, Catherine Sneed from EPA, who has actually the overall need for MARSIM revision 2. Also, we should not forget the contribution from our colleagues from other agencies that their name is not mentioned here, but they did contribute significantly to development of MARSIM Revision 2, and those are representatives from EPA. Again, they are not mentioned their names from DOE, DOD, and USNRC. With this, I will start with the next slide. My presentation, actually, it will be presented in three tiers approach, or three parts. The first part, I will be talking about MARSIM Revision 2, the status and update. And then the second part, talking about the survey characterization for subsurface, because it is another issue, because MARSIM covers only surface contamination, survey, and characterization. The third part, I will touch base at very high level about potential use in the survey and characterization of new technologies, and then I will end my presentation with a summary and conclusion. First, I will start with part one about MARSIM Revision 2 and update. Again, to summarize, just to give you background about MARSIM Revision 2, it involved four federal agency members. They participated in that revision, and they are namely Department of Defense, Air Force, the Army, the Navy representatives, Department of Energy, Environmental Protection Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. As you know, this is similar to other kinds of families of multi-agency documents that already they were developed. So MARSIM was developed originally and published in 1997 and revised in 2001. We call it Revision 1. However, MARSIM has never been updated since 2001. So the other member of the family of the multi-agency documents, they are MARLAB, which is Multi-Agency Radiological Laboratory Analytical Protocols, which was published by 2004, and the EPA lead, they have also a lead. John Griggs has the lead for MARLAB, and then MARSIM also, though it is considered addendum to MARSIM, but also it was published in 2009, mostly involved how you do the survey and characterization of instruments and tools and other materials. The technical guidance document that I will be talking about, MARSIM, it is actually, it's not policy, it is absolutely a technical document, does not involve policies, but it actually presents approaches to survey and characterization that the federal agencies, they are more or less, they are aligned in these kind of approaches. Again, the question is raised is, why MARSIM? Why survey and characterization? How it is related to remediation? Some people, they may think that, well, you know, it is peripheral activities to the remediation. I would disagree with that and say survey and characterization of radiological contamination is very important aspect of the remediation. The reason is you establish remediation criteria for contaminated site, and the question how you demonstrate compliance with that criteria, how can you do the survey, how can you do the characterization in order to do the remediation. I believe this is an essential segment or essential part of the remediation process as a whole, because currently with our EPA, NRC, or DOE, they have their release criteria, either risk or dose, which is those members of the public. And if they release criteria, for example, in the commissioning for NIC, which is 25 millirem, and EPA about 12 millirem per year, and the question how you do that, how you demonstrate that, what kind of level of activities that you need to know in the environmental media in order to release the site or the facility. So the process first, you need to translate that level of risk or level of dose into actual concentration or radioactivity level that you could measure in the field, because you cannot measure in the field radiation dose from all pathways. You could measure direct exposure pathway, but you cannot measure other kind from the using the dose criteria. You need to do modeling analysis in order to derive the concentration that could meet these criteria. And those are known as DCGL, derived concentration guideline levels. And then you need to conduct the survey and characterization whether you meet those levels or not, what kind of remediation you have, what kind of technology that you apply, what kind of statistical test in order to demonstrate compliance for the regulator, and then you could make a decision to release that site. And MARSIM is involved in the two processes, which is survey and sampling as well in the statistical test. Now I will focus on MARSIM Revision 2 overview. It covers real property, which is surface soil and building surfaces. And please remember, I'm talking about surfaces. Surface soil, for example, in the top 15 centimeter or so, and the building surfaces in the top 1 centimeter where you have the contamination located at. So for subsurface, it's a different kind of approach that I will be talking about. It provides guidance for defensible and rigorous surveys for cleanup especially the final status survey, and uses a graded approach starting with historical site assessment. Again, I reemphasize that MERSIM was not updated since 2001, and then currently we almost completed, federal agencies completed revision 2 of MERSIM. Now, try to address the revisions that MERSIM revision 2 is actually what kind of revision that we have, just to give you information. And by the way, MERSIM revision 2 will be available shortly to the public, still is not available for public comment. So I would recommend to watch when MERSIM comes for the public and look at these revisions. And that's the reason we're presenting that, to show you the kind of revision that we have currently in the MERSIM new version to take a look at and try to provide comments on that. First, the planned revision is to include the MQO, which is the measuring quality objective. And MERSIM, MARLAB, they do have the MQO, whereas the currently, since we are using actually the survey directly for the site survey, this means that we need to look into again into the revision how we address the measurement quality objective. I will emphasize the measurement quality objective for discrete sampling when you conduct in the lab. It is also important, but when you do even the survey at large for the site, that it is direct survey, this is, could be different, and that's the reason for this kind of revision for the survey. So we expanded the measurement methods to include scan survey only. Again, the measurement for scan survey only, and the quality for the measurement, it is quite important, because actually in terms of representation for the area of interest, it is already covered because you are doing scanning survey, whereas for discrete sampling, you are more concerned about representation of the sampling. So therefore, the revision that it considers the expanded measurement to have the scan-only surveys and what kind of MQOs that we have. So again, the MERSIM was written in 1995, and later actually guidance was developed. And then we are trying to address those guidance documents. So we update the status of radiation instrumentation as well. So also the revision, the update survey instrumentation, as I mentioned, because you may have scan-only survey measurement and techniques that we are using. So the survey instrumentation is being updated in order to consider more the field survey that can be used, and those are included in Chapter 6 of Revision 2 and in Appendix H of the survey instrumentation of that revised version. Another activity which we call Scenario B. Scenario B is actually where we assume that the site will meet the release criteria, whereas Scenario A, which is the overall general scenario, that we assume that does not meet the criteria, and you have to prove that based on sampling and based on measurement. So therefore, we try to address the Scenario B. And Scenario B is important, specifically when the contamination is almost close to background. So it is not practical to assume that when you say that this is clean and not really impacted, so it is important to make sure that, yes, it is clean and impacted, and we use Scenario B. So we're addressing Scenario B. And in Scenario B, you could see the distribution sometimes of the error. For the gross gamma survey, it is actually more detailed, is expanded, so therefore it needs to be dealt in a different way, and this is where the revision the revision 2 on MERSIM is taking care of that. MERSIM, which is for the instrumentation, for the other one, allows for use of Scenario B and already used in some states that they are using also MARSIM. Again, the statistic that they use, Wilkinson rank testing for the scenario A, this is the example for the general. You are looking into the potential error if you assume that the survey unit actually meet the criteria and you assume that below the DCGL level, and this is the error that you assume is B, and whereas if it is, you assume it is higher, this means you need to remediate more. It is it is called alpha error that you have, and the gray region in delta is between the DCGL and the lower region. We call it LBGR, which is the lower bound of the gray region. And the revision 2 actually rephrased and tried to illustrate further the LBGR to represent a conservative estimate of the remaining residual radioactive material in the survey unit, if there is any. Other activity for revision, the hotspots. For the hotspots, that sometimes you have very small area that is highly contaminated than the overall DCGL for the survey unit. And the question is how to deal with the hotspot. If the hotspot is small, and then you cannot assume that the same exposure scenario for the hotspot that it is for the overall unit because of the size of area and the exposure. So therefore, for each hotspot, the in revision 2, that we developed that the approach where you have the DCGL for hotspot 1, DCGL for hotspot 2, and so on, and try to make sure that the DCGL for the integrated hotspots is less than one unit of the DCGL that is required. And this means that the way that the revision 2 address try to alternate the language to address the concerns about the current hotspots. And this is really giving more flexibility in MARSIM. Again, other revision include information on survey requirements for discrete radioactive particles. Certain particles are very, very small, and then it does not make sense actually to assess those based on area. And because they are discrete, actually areas, that the question is how to deal with it. So the way to deal with it should be not based on area, based on exposure rather than on area. So you cannot assume a scenario for land with different activities and then try to derive the DCGL for these particles. So the revision 2 try to address actually these, we call it hot particles. And the area was defined actually in the technical review for MARSIM that the group, they agreed that if it is the area that it is the hot spot for the small area, we call it the hot, sometimes hot particles, is less than 3 times the distance between the detector and the particle or the elevated area. This means you need to use different kind of approach rather than to consider it as an area, so you consider actually the dose impact from that elevated small areas or the hotspot. So the methodology becomes unwieldy at these certain small sizes, so you need to approach different methodology and modeling pathways. They are different for discrete. So the group, they develop some kind of approach for those modeling for that with a flexibility. You try to have it on a case-by-case basis to assess the kind of impact from these very small areas or hot particles. Also, MARSIM use AMTRICA requirement, which includes specific averaging for areas concentration. The planned revision evaluation of the measured uncertainty in the selection for measurement methods. Uncertainty is becoming very important. So selecting the measurement method will ultimately impact the survey cost and statistical power of the sampling design. And the measurement or samples used and the compliance decisions are typically analyzed with a very high precision. Therefore, it's very important to address the uncertainty. It is the required to have high precision data because they may cost or schedule prohibitive even when there is cause for remediation. If you did not consider the measurement and uncertainty, you may end with very high cost, and it is required and to demonstrate the compliance concerning these uncertainties. Again, considering uncertainty is part of the risk-informed approach. So without considering uncertainties, you may come to a conclusion that is unrealistic. Also, it is for less precise methods that when you use that initially, because it happened actually in some cases for the survey, certain methods that they were used and they were less precise, but the uncertainty was not addressed. So therefore, it's important that to address uncertainty for using different methods and different techniques. And this was also revised and addressed in the revision number 2. Also, planned revisions, in some cases, you need to consider alternative sampling methods. And Oak Ridge and Associate University proposed an approach for the rank set of sampling techniques. And this is really sometimes, you know, it could work specifically for hard-to-detect radionuclides. In certain cases, what we mean by hard-to-detect, certain radionuclides you cannot, it is hard to detect because either they are beta emitter or they are not actually conspicuous in the, they are not within terms of concentration. So sometimes you try to relate it to other kind of radionuclides that you can detect. So Oak Ridge and Associate University proposed an approach, and we did have added actually in an appendix, I believe, to revision number 2 in order to consider this situation. Having just summarized these important revisions and the revision number 2, the next step that for all federal agencies to concur on revision 2, I believe some federal agencies concurred on, NRC did concur on revision number 2 after the complete concurrence. So this will go back to EPA in order to issue the Federal Register notice and to submit the draft MARSIM revision 2. Already this is done, it's already submitted actually to Science Advisory Board for review, and there will be a revision in December, and hopefully this process for SAB will be done in January timeframe, I believe. So we are looking forward for the Federal Register notice to come out in order for the public to provide comments and focusing on the revision just I mentioned. And of course, the next step, of course, revisions and additional changes could be made based on SAB direction, Science Advisory Board direction, and based on public comments received. So the group will be meeting to discuss all of those comments and try to address the comments that we receive from SAB and the public. Now, after completing the surface characterization in MARSIM Revision 2 and the revision, so I will try to focus on issue that we tried to address earlier, that MARSIM Revision 2 does not address exactly, it may be touch base on that, but does not address exactly, which is subsurface, how you conduct subsurface survey and characterization. We tried to propose some time ago, you know, about, you know, less than a decade, about 8 years ago, to propose to develop actually what's called MARSAS. It is, again, multi-agencies manual for subsurface characterization, but the priority was given for revising current MARSIM for surface characterization and survey. As I mentioned that, we try to address subsurface decision and model supporting environmental compliance. The NRC started that by contracting the University of Tennessee And we work together actually with University of Tennessee. Some of you may know Robert Stewart. We did work with him to develop a new rig, to develop some kind of approaches for subsurface model and support and sampling for subsurface, because to conduct sampling for subsurface using the surface phenomena for or sampling protocols, it will be unwise to do that. And the reason is that the main issue with adapting Martin to subsurface, because the subsurface is difficult to access and sampling is too costly. So if you conduct, you know, drill holes, you know, considering what kind of sampling protocols you have for surface, you are really going to be, it will cost too much. That's number one. And it will be difficult to do that. And number two, it is not just the cost. You may actually have reverse effect that for damaging the environment by drilling so many holes. The other issue is the volume. We are dealing with volume, then in this case, not really with surface contamination. So it's different kind of approach that we need to use. Then also, the no comprehensive scan is possible because you could do an overall scan using the surface, whereas for subsurface, you cannot do simply for gamma detection. So if you go to a few feet down, just you cannot detect, you know, the contamination there. So the other approach is, because it is not obvious how we apply Marsden statistical approach to the subsurface, and we need to think more seriously about the Bayesian approach. The Bayesian approach is actually, you do not assume that it is the, as I said for scenario A, that the unit, the survey unit, is actually not clean. So you cannot make that assumption. You must have more information about that from subsurface, from modeling, as well as from groundwater monitoring. So you may have more information about the subsurface. So the Bayesian approach could be more appropriate to do. Now, since we did address that initially in URIG 7021, just to summarize the approach, it assumes that the decision, that a decision limit is available. You may assess initially some kind of derived decision based on just what kind of information you have about the site, and then based on the vaded zone to groundwater if you have the source term that is going, and going if you have groundwater contamination, based on future excavation scenario, what kind of scenario that you have for the dose impact, how the site is going to be used, what kind of excavation that you have, you bring the material in subsurface up, and this is the scenario that you could use to derive the DCGLs. And also, you need to assume that the concentration could vary with depth, so it's actually more likely you look at the trend, how the concentration is decreasing with depth, when you consider the vaded zone from bleaching. And if it is increasing, this means you need to follow up. And it can vary with spatial scale. So it is not actually the area, the whole area, that you assume is contaminated. It may be there are some preferred, actually, direction where contamination is moving to, that you need to take this into consideration. Also makes empirical use of all available information when you consider the subsurface. The information relevant to exceedance of the decision limit, and you need to address that and provide means to optimally locate boreholes. So it could actually support you, this kind of modeling and this kind of approach, where you locate your boreholes, not just to put it randomly anywhere that you wish. And spatial distribution of contamination, expressing contamination concern map. So you try first to start initial contamination of concern map and not to take the whole area as contaminated, as I said. And then the approach, it is from cradle to grave and provides tools that facilitate empirical evolution of the CCM and emphasize use of EPA triad model, that EPA that they use, how to address the risk and how to address contamination. for remediation. The statistical, also there was a software that we developed initially, still it is, needs to be more updated, about the, it's called SEDA, which is the Statistical Analysis Decision Assistance, and this is SEDA, and we looked into the approaches for that. The approach is simply, just to give you that, we look at layers, okay, with depth. If you have thick contamination, and the contamination varies, so this means you take layer by layer, and each layer, you assess the contamination in each layer, how it is, what kind of concentration. In addition, you need to combine characterization and risk in this case, because the layer at a depth of 1 foot or 2 feet or 3 feet is different than the layer with contamination at the depth of 10 feet. Therefore, you cannot just assume the risk from that contamination at the shallow, at shallow level is the same as the risk from the contamination at the lower level. I'm talking about the bedded zone in this case, of course. So therefore, this is the just roughly, you know, in the layman language, the approach that we are trying to use. So these tools, they include integrated models for visualization. We need to have these tools, the spatial analysis, the statistical analysis, as well as the human health risk approach, as well as we address ecological risk. There is any impact to the, of course, through the groundwater movement. And also we need to assess the risk-benefit analysis when we do the sampling and the contamination. So the risk-benefit analysis will help what kind of remediation that you need to do, where to remediate, and what kind of remediation tools and technology that you use. So the capabilities of SEDA can be used independently or collectively to address the site-specific subsurface concerns, and also need to combine it with other characterization and survey tools that you have. And these just, they show just how can the different kind of layering and the approach that could tell you the kind of contamination and where the contamination is, what kind of depth of the well that or the sampling, the borehole that you need to have, it gives you this information. Now I will try to provide, this is just an overview for the subsurface. The current status of subsurface, the NRC initiated that process for addressing the licensee needs because the licensee, they were faced with this approach. And we are soliciting stakeholders' interest in this regard to give us ideas about the subsurface problems. And because we have this issue for certain sites, We did contract ECNA without giving any kind of promotional, just to mention that we are trying to have contractors to deal with this issue and then to study what kind of approaches they have. And our contractor is developing white paper for generic approach to subsurface survey and characterization to enhance our guidance in this area. And then currently also we are updating our guidance for if we can. We are using it as starting point in a new rig 7021. And then also we have some updates related to subsurface surveys, which will be published in new rig 1757 volume 2, revision 2. And following the development of the white paper, after the white paper is issued actually regarding the approaches for subsurface, we are trying to plant a workshop with interested stakeholders to get their input on what is needed in guidance, and then a multi-agency working group for radiological subsurface assessment and survey could be established. For that's why we'll go back to have as our, you know, federal agencies, interested federal agencies in this topic to move forward with that in order to have MARSA's guidance if we can in the future. The third tier or the third part of my presentation about the new technologies for potential use in survey and characterization. There are lots of new technologies that have been developed around the world in dealing with survey and characterization. I will go just quite fast for those survey and characterization. The new technologies for radiological surveillance characterization in support of cleanup and remediation are developing fast. And for example, nanomaterial for cleanup of uranium has been tried or tested but needs further development. Nanomaterial technology, we did have a session by FRTR to address nanomaterial that can be used for remediation of groundwater and specifically uranium in groundwater and uranium mines. So we need to develop this further and to look into this further. So we need to look into the new technologies to have an awareness and for exchange of information so we can discuss among ourselves about potential use and development. We need to explore potential application and development and address issues when we use these new technologies to demonstrate compliance. What are these issues that we'll be faced with? What are the advantages of new technologies? Enhanced remediation and cleanup. It is in a much faster and smarter way. Reduce exposure to workers and the public. Minimize environmental damage. Reduce cost. Reduce implementation time frame. And enhance the risk-informed. And currently we are using the risk-smart approach at the NRC. And then we welcome any kind of new technologies that we can develop and we can apply in our compliance. Other example for the use of new technologies that the use of unmanned aerial vehicles for gamma survey and gamma scan. So the ground-based gamma survey typically used. Currently, we are using GPS-based detector system, and these systems, they are mounted on backpacks of technicians or pushcarts or vehicles, and these days, such survey may result in unsafe conditions. So in case that we have unsafe conditions and we need to look at certain areas, I believe that these UAVs, they can be actually very helpful. Helicopters and fixed-wing planes were used before. However, because they are expensive and because sometimes accessibility could be an issue when you use those tools. So therefore, aerial platform for performing surveys in accessible areas, it is being developed fast by commercial companies all over the world, and the drone-based survey capabilities were developed primarily for use in mapping radiation levels. I believe it has been used and tested for uranium recovery sites, and these include areas within and around abundant uranium mines, as I mentioned, and also in some cases for culturally sensitive areas on national labs and some military installation that they could be actually useful to be used in radiological survey. Again, other technologies being developed for survey and characterization, robotic and remote handling technologies, they were used frequently in high radiation area in case you need to do survey high radiation area for characterization on survey. These technologies have been used by DOE. Also, UK used it in the SILA field activities that they have for cleanup activities. They are used frequently for dismantling and laser cutting, too, for these kinds of remote handling technologies, and also for used for in radiation detection of leakage. In case that you have leakage that you could use remote technologies, Japan used it, and DOE for Hanford tanks and other areas also, I believe, it has been used. I'm showing examples here to give you an idea of the images that they were used, for example, of the recent development for laser cutting tools and robotic arms tools in order to handle radioactive material and also to reduce the level of radioactivity for the workers and also to segregate some kind of high-level radioactive material. Other example in Japan, after Fukushima accident, Japan developed also were quite active for developing new technologies. Those are other examples just to look into. You could go to Japan Nehara Center, that's a kind of R&D development, and those are developing fast. All of a sudden, we see those technologies that have been applied actually in remediation of different kinds of facilities on sites. In summary, I would like to conclude by indicating that radiological survey and characterization are important aspects of the cleanup and remediation of radiological and hazardous contaminants. So we need to consider those and always to follow up what kind of technology is being available or developed. Federal agencies essentially developed consensus approaches in MRSIM guidance for surface radiological survey, and it is currently being revised and updated, and soon, hopefully, it will be available as MRSIM Revision 2. And there is a need to develop further approaches and methods and software for subsurface characterization and survey. Development of consensus guidance harmonized with the concerned federal agency in a collaborative effort would be beneficial to everybody, reducing costs, and we learn from each other. So therefore, there is a need for knowledge and awareness of new and advanced technology for characterization and survey of radiological and hazardous contamination to support remediation, and we need to explore potential application of these technologies for application in order to demonstrate compliance with the regulation for release of contaminated facilities. Thank you very much. If there is any question, I would like to answer.
All right. Thank you so very much. We did have a question about MRSIM, and this specific question asks if MRSIM allows for incremental sampling methodology to be used in soil.
I believe so. I think with the new revision, yes, it does allow, but I could also refer to Kathy Sneed in order to answer that if there is further information on that.
Sure. Kathy, are you with us on the phone?
I am. This is Catherine Sneed. So there's nothing that says that you can't use incremental sampling in conjunction with MRSIM, but the statistical treatment would be a little bit different, and you'd want to make sure that you used all of the best practices for incremental sampling in order to make sure that you kept your measurement quality objectives to the best. So, yes, I think you can use the two together.
All right, great. Thank you. I think just this in the interest
Cynthia Barr.
Of time. Oh, go ahead.
All right. This is Cynthia Barr. I just wanted to say that New Reg 1757, Volume 2, Revision 2 does have, well, actually it's in the current version, but Appendix C does have guidance on double sampling and two-stage sampling. So I just wanted to point the person who asked the question to our guidance. And if they have any questions, they can follow up with us.
All right, great. Thank you so much. I believe right now at this point, I just wanted to thank everybody again for Bobby and Catherine and Cynthia for sharing their knowledge. I think we're going to move on to our next item on the agenda, just in the interest of time, and then we may come back for some other questions later on today. So the next elements on today's agenda are the agency announcements. So I wanted to just put our agency representatives on alert that we'll be asking some of you to come off of mute in order to share your updates. So again, I'm going to move forward here in these presentation items and just remind everybody if any of our agency reps were listening online, make sure you turn that volume down so that we don't have an echo when you speak on the phones. And we'll go ahead and bring up our first agency representative. So Malcolm Garg, please feel free to unmute and share your updates.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Malcolm Garg. I just give you a quick update. I'm going to speak about the Army's Environmental Division at the headquarter level. And then later on, we'll have someone from our environmental programs at the U.S. Army Environmental Command speak about some stuff. So essentially, we are now known as the G9 ISE, Installation Services Environmental. And we are the Army proponent for Army Environmental. And this is all, we're a large organization, so this would include the Army National Guard, the U.S. Army Environmental Command, and the BRAC Division. And we also advise Army leadership, establish priorities, execution priorities, resourcing, implementing policies, strategic plans, and program guidance. So it's really a very broad program we have. And I just wanted to touch on, since PFAS is sort of the topic of the day, and guidance updates. We're currently updating our PFAS drinking water guidance and also our restoration, our cleanup guidance, to reflect the changes happening around the country. And just to touch on, we do much more of this, actually, than what I've listed, but tech coordination. Right now, we're currently doing some research programs on contaminant treatment and mitigation, such as PFAS, 1,4-dioxane, perchlorate, new chrome coatings. RDX is another one, and these are really just our emergent contaminants. Also, the Army Public Health Command has been doing a lot of good work on PFAS toxicity, and as I said, we're actually doing much more than just these, but it's an example of where we coordinate and what we do. And really, that's all I have for the headquarters program. If anyone needs to reach out to find out more, you know, please contact me, and we will try to help. So thank you.
All right, thank you so very much. I will remind the audience, if you have questions or comments, you can put those into the Q&A window at any time. Just in the interest of time, we're going to be collecting those questions and comments electronically. So although there is a chance to raise your hand, we were going to ask you to type in those questions and comments electronically so we can try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have today. So I believe we're ready to move on to our next agency representative. So if we could have Andy Anders please come off of mute and share her comments. And so, Andy, I'm going to help here. I'm going to push a button here to try to help you unmute.
Okay, did that work?
That worked.
Oh, good, thank you. U.S. Army Environmental Command is now a major subordinate command in the U.S. Army Materiel Command. And we have cleanup, oversight, and funding of 143 continental U.S. installations and 17 outside the continental U.S. installations. We're located at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, where the temperature is now 73 degrees and sunny. We have many, many projects and initiatives. I'm going to cover just a couple of them here. We do evaluation assessment of regulation and legislative impacts for early. I get all the ones that relate to toxicology and emerging contaminants. We are also the home for, in my branch, the National Defense Center for Energy and the Environment, NDCEE. And NDCEE can be found on the web easily. You'll find that there's a lot of research going on. Our programs are limited to not more than $1 million each, so it's not high dollar. But it's substantial dollars, and so anybody that's interested in demonstration validation of technologies they have that they want to get them valid at Army sites, that's the place to go and start looking. We do a lot of tech transfer of new, exciting environmental technologies. We do site characterizations, many, many, many more things. We're extremely busy. And we like it that way. If you have any more information that you'd like to get, please contact me, and you'll see my contact email is right there. And we have a website. You can go and check that out. Thank you all for joining. I hope all of you stay healthy and well, and your families are all well, and hope you all have a really good, happy Thanksgiving. Take care. Over.
Thank you so very much. All right, I appreciate those information updates, and I think we're getting ready to turn it over to our next agency representative, and that's Dan Powell. So, Dan, if you could unmute and share your updates for us.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Jean. I appreciate that. And I did unmute, and hopefully the slides will stay a little more stable this time. But anyway, just a few announcements here. Number one, I just want to mention two new publications that have come out of the Office of Superfund Radiation Technology Innovation. The first is our 2020 Optimization Progress Report. I mentioned during my remarks that we've looked at over close to 400 optimization projects so far, right, close to 300 sites. And what we do is every 2 to 3 years, we go back and look at the recommendations that were implemented, give them a few years to work their way through the process, and then we go back and see what our status is on implementing those. I do it for 2 points. Number one, to see how many we're implementing and how we're working in that area. And then number two, to see if we see any trends, and that kind of feeds our efforts to develop best management practices. This current report looks at 2015 through 2017, and that report is available and online. We've left out a link on this, but maybe we can put that up in the notes for later. But again, the gist of the report is that out of the optimization recommendations we've put in place that came out of the optimization studies, roughly two-thirds of them have been implemented or in progress or planned, and the majority of the remainder are still under consideration. So significant progress in implementing those recommendations, and that's what the report covers. Another document was actually part of our administrator's Superfund Task Force recommendations. One of the products that we put forward was an effort to try to help folks do a better job of scoping, apply some of these best practices that I've mentioned before. And that's our RFIS scoping guide that was recently released. Again, this really focuses on EPA lead remedial RFIS work, but there are some practices and guidelines to help streamline the process. And again, the idea is to more efficiently scope what's going on, apply things like strategic investigation and sampling approaches, and help improve data management sites. And that was released as well. From our Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, announcements, a couple of announcements here. One is that the Federal Agency Hazardous Waste Compliance Document with update number 38 was published on October 29th, 2020 in the Federal Register. It includes 8 additions to the docket and 6 deletions from the docket. So the total number of facilities on the Federal Agency Hazardous Waste Compliance Docket now stands at 2,380, and you see a link there. And then I'll move to the next slide. The other thing to talk about was the EPA PFAS Action Plan. It covers a variety of key actions in helping to address, I mentioned, the emerging contaminant issue of PFAS, and you can see some of the areas that it's dealing with, both in terms of guidance, research, as well as regulatory activities for PFO and PFOS. Right now, we have several analytical methods have been put forward, Office of Water Method 537.1, 533, our waste site, hazardous waste site methods, SW846, and method 8327. Has been gone through a multi-lab validation, but it has not yet been finalized. And the Office of Water is working with DOD as well as our Office of Land Emergency Management for multi-lab validation. of isotopic dilution. There's a monitoring rule that went forward. You can see that there. It's an OMB, looking at nationwide drinking water monitoring for PFAS, lower concentrations. And then in terms of treatment, you can see there are a couple of different projects underway, EPA research to remove PFAS from drinking water, looking at household water filters to protect the water in your home. And EPA researchers are also studying how materials containing PFAS should be safely managed and disposed of, studying the best ways to dispose of PFAS and understand how PFAS at contaminated industrial sites may move into nearby environment. If you have any information, if you need more information on the PFAS action plan, you see your key points of contacts within the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office. It's Mary Cook. And within the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation, that's Linda Gaines. And there we also have epa.gov/PFAS website. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much, Dan. I did want you to know we were able to find that link to the optimization report, and I put it into the Q&A and URLs window for everybody. All right. We'll move on to our next agency representative. So let's see if, pardon me, if Tanya is on the line. Tanya, if you could unmute your line.
Okay. Good afternoon. This is Tanya Gallegos with USGS. I wanted to call your attention to a few technical announcements we have. As always, you can find the most recent announcements at usgs.gov. And there you can find various announcements within our various mission areas at USGS. And these include energy and minerals, water, ecosystems, core science systems, and natural hazards. I wanted to call your attention to a specific announcement, and that relates to our efforts in the PFAS arena. USGS has recently developed a PFAS capability team, and that is specifically to collaborate and coordinate the different PFAS subjects across our various mission areas at USGS. And so that group will include efforts along the lines of developing lab and field methods. And if you want to find more information, please visit our website, which is listed here. And for more information, you can contact Mary Kay Foley at mkfoley@usgs.gov or myself, Tanya Gallegos, tgallegos@usgs.gov. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so very much. So we'll move on to our next agency representative. And if I could please have Carla unmute yourself.
Hello. This is Carla Hari. I'm with the Naval Facilities Engineering. And you're not on the right slide, I don't believe. There we go. Oops. Are you on the right slide?
Bear with me, Carla. I'm trying to... Oh, yeah, I can hear you. I'm just trying to find my way over to your materials. I apologize. Looks like
right.
We had them there. There they go.
There we are. Okay, great. Back to, I am with the Naval Facilities Engineering Systems Command, and I wanted to make sure this was up on the slide because we have a new name. As you can see, we have the word systems now in our title. I am with the Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center, which is located out of Fort Wainimi, but I'm representing all of NASAC today. So I'm going to provide some updates here related to our website and guidance documents and fact sheets. Our website, I presented our website to you all in the past, but it has gone through a very large restructuring and update to our content this year. It's been a very large effort of ours. And we believe it's greatly improved. So I encourage you to go take a look at it. It still is our one-stop resource for our Navy environmental project managers our contractors, our consultants, and all stakeholders, and even the general public that might be interested in environmental site cleanup. And pretty much, you know, everything that we produce as far as tech transfer information is posted to this website. The website was done under the oversight of a users group, so it should be much easier to navigate and find information now. I wanted to mention that we still continue with providing a webinar series called the Open Environmental Restoration Resources Webinar. It's open to the general public. Although we don't have a topic coming up very soon, but we do have all of these available archived on our website. So you go to the link up above and go to training and then OER2. And you can go, these are only the past few in the last few months, but it goes back a few years for archived webinars. We have two new guidance documents that came out in 2020. The first one here listed is, it's a new guidance for our Navy project managers, you know, who are managing and executing our sediment dredging projects, and particularly our projects that are dredging in areas of known or suspected or suspected of containing munitions and explosives of concern or potentially presenting an explosive hazard. So as we know, there would be some very specific considerations, and this guidance document provides that. It provides an overview, of course, of MEC in the underwater environment, an overview of explosive safety policies. It gives some pre-design and planning considerations and some dredging options and generally just other considerations to make sure that our projects, our sediment dredging projects, are executed in a manner that's protective of human health and the environment. The second guidance that is listed here is the NAFAC guidance for the remedial alternatives analysis, and this actually updates our 2012 guidance on RAAs, and it's in accordance with our Navy's optimization policy. The remedial alternatives analysis, it is a required step for all of our Navy environmental restoration projects to make sure that we are considering at the right point in our projects, early in the process, that we're looking at all of the potential remedial alternatives. And we're developing our remedial action objectives and remediation goals in an appropriate manner. So this new guidance describes what the requirement is and the review process, and also provides a template. Moving on to fact sheets and handbooks, we have four new ones here that I've presented and will be available and are available on the website. The first one is a fact sheet for innovative sampling methods and data analysis to reduce long-term monitoring costs. You know, the Navy has hundreds of sites where we conduct long-term monitoring and we track contaminant concentration over time. And sometimes it's difficult to identify the trends because there is some site-to-site variability. And so this fact sheet attempts to, you know, provide some information on how to manage this variability and also give some additional methods for more accurate analysis of trends. So we found that to be a useful fact sheet. The second guidance here is on incremental sampling methodology. It describes advantages and limitations of using the ISM approach. And specifically at Navy site types. So there are Navy site types that may or may not be suitable for its use. And we know skeet ranges, small arm ranges, MRP sites, you know, this is an applicable methodology, and other sites maybe not. So this document gives some of the many relevant factors to consider with respect to incremental sampling methodology. The third fact sheet here is on in-situ chemical reduction. It describes the state of the practice of in-situ chemical reduction and really primarily focuses on zero-valent iron as, you know, being the most common amendment used to treat chlorinated solvents. The last fact sheet here is in situ chemical oxidation, and this is a fact sheet that we have updated from 2011, and it gives some additional lessons learned that we have learned, you know, over the years throughout its implementation of the technology. Let's see, looking forward to what we hope to present in, and we plan to present in the spring meeting. We've been working very hard on finalizing our PFAS guidance frequently asked questions and answers, so I hope to be able to present that in the spring timeframe to you all. That I know is a topic for everyone, of interest to everyone. So that's all I have to present today. If you should need any other information, please feel free to contact me, and I'll get right back to you. And thanks a lot for joining me today.
Thank you so very much. All right, I believe we're ready to move on to our next agency representative. And I believe, Bobby, we would like to have you come back on to update for the NRC.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thank you. We try to announce, you know, 2IA safety standard. The reason we are doing that because the NRC actually has the lead for interacting with IAEA regarding developing standards for waste management and decommissioning. And currently, there are two standards that are being developed by IAEA. And then, you know, the steps for revision of IAEA safety standard, they go through 12 steps. So they go first steps by having the profile of what they are, what these standards they are approved, and then they go for revision by the committees. Currently, these standards, they are going through revision by the committees. And then after the revision by the committees and approved, they come for member state review. Therefore, because I believe those standards, they are important, and as you know, the NRC does not adopt IAEA safety standard to use it. We do not, but we use it as a point of reference when we develop our regulation or standards. So therefore, we need to take a look at them, but they do not impact our regulations, but they may be considered when we develop our guidance or regulations. That's the reason I'm listing those. The other reason is because for member state review, we like to have member states, including all concerned federal agencies, to take a look at them and provide comments on those standards and submit it to us as a coordinator. I am currently the coordinator for review, and Trish Holohan, she is the USA representative on that committee. So we need to hear from all the concerned parties, including federal agencies, as well as from agencies of the states, to hear regarding those standards, because we could impact actually during the transport of this material through the United States if they come and they accepted, you know, to come to the United States. So they could impact actually the way we are doing business. And those standards, number one, it is the draft safety standard DS-14-499 about application of the concept of exemption. And this is, I provided the IAEA website. You go and look at the website and click on copy, because there are lots of other information coming from other countries. So don't worry about that. Just look at the copy, which is called clean copy, and look at it. Try it. Still is not filed, still is being reviewed, and then by the committees, and then, but it will be good to hear from anybody interested about those standards. The other one, which is even more important, which is about clearance. As you know, we do not have regulation for clearance. So if the material is cleared and they come through and being transported, this means that we'll be impacted by it when they are transported within the United States and how they are used. So it is important to take a look at those. And those standards, the link again is provided there. And then the link, you will find again lots of information and comments, including USA early comments on that, and just you click on the S500 clean, you'll see that standard, and please take a look at it. If you have any initial advanced comments, let me know about it. I would appreciate it. I provide my website there, so you can provide me any comments that you may have. So early we can coordinate when they come for member state review. I can coordinate with those interested in those standards. So again, I would appreciate any comments. And again, just emphasize those standards, they are not part of NRC regulation. We do not adopt IE safety standards, but we maybe they are impacted if the material comes to the United States as cleared material. And thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And then our last representative announcement, Heather Henry, if you're on the line, please unmute and share your remarks.
Hi, Jean. Thank you. I just have a few announcements, and thank you very much for including us today. We're the Superfund Research Program, which is a part of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and we fund research and remediation technologies, detection technologies, as well as toxicology and research that helps us understand susceptibility and risk of hazardous substances in the environment. Something that might be of interest to this community, we are in the process of featuring our newly funded Superfund Research Program Center grants. And this has been going over the past couple of months. We have a number of sessions that the archives are available on CLUIN, metals, emerging, and legacy contaminants, as well as vulnerable populations. And then it's not too late. Tomorrow is our emerging exposures session, which will feature PFAS, PCBs, and persistent radicals. We're also excited to be shifting to a virtual technology fair on December 16th. Usually we do this as a in-person actual technology fair as part of our annual meeting. However, things have changed, and we're going to do this in virtually. So we are going to feature our small business remediation and technology, detection technology grantees. And we encourage those of you who are on the line. We'd like to include you on the line. If you're interested, just let me know. Also, we do have an ongoing solicitation. One is for application assistance program. Those are due on December 12th. And this is an opportunity for underrepresented businesses, whether that's minority-owned or female-owned businesses, to apply for assistance in putting together a small business innovative research grant application. And in addition to the AAP program, we do have the Small Business Innovative Research Grant due dates on January 5th, April 5th, and September 5th of every year. And if anybody has questions, I'm the point of contact. And that's all. Thank you, Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much, Heather. I believe we're ready to move on to our last segment in today's session. So I'm going to turn back to Kent Glover. Kent, I've got your closing materials here on the screen, and I'll also remind the audience we've brought back those questions from earlier as well. So,
yes, thank you. Well, I just want to take about 10 minutes here. It's been a long seminar or webinar, and I just want to take 10 minutes to circle back to some of the points that Dan Powell made in his presentation, and then use that as a springboard for discussion of FRTR priorities for the next couple of years. Do I have control of this? I do. Okay, very good, very good. And so we'll go to, okay. So where were we 30 years ago, to remind everyone of what Dan talked about? In 1990, technologies for characterization and for cleanup or treatment were largely adopted technology from related industries, like water resource investigations and water treatment, water wastewater treatment industry. And they were quite effective for certain things. We were able to identify contaminant extent and receptors fairly well at scales of tens of meters to kilometers. And we were able to, with pump and treat systems, control or contain plume migration, things like that, and a lot of work done with either Dignall or CAPS or what have you, different techniques for dealing with ongoing sources and hot spots. But federal agencies started to realize we shared some challenges, and Dan talked at length about this. Challenges that the agency shared among us in terms of attaining cleanup goals with an acceptable time frame, and how to promote the use of innovative technologies. We found that these efforts were inhibited by a lack of performance cost data, and Dan talked about that. And we had challenges in monitoring, demonstrating the efficacy of remediation methods in general. And so recognizing these shared challenges was really the motivation for FRTR 30 years ago. And so that's, Dan talked about how the FRTR was formed and focused on things like identifying shared challenges and evaluating new treatment characterization technologies and ways of promoting and advancing use of innovative technologies and solutions for site cleanup, full site cleanup, and doing a lot of technology transfer, got that going early on. So where'd that lead us? So that led us to today, and we have seen, as Dan talked about, a tremendous growth over the years in technologies really aimed at in situ treatment and destructive technologies. And I think Dan illustrated fairly well how FRTR played a meaningful role in advancing these new technologies to wide use for full-scale remediation. But as we started to do that, we started to develop optimization and performance monitoring requirements, it's really driven a need to refine our conceptual site models. Which we learned through R&D efforts in one way or another. Contaminant fate treatment were controlled by processes that were operating at centimeter or meter scale. And our existing characterization technologies weren't so well adapted to those scales. And everybody on this webinar is well aware of some of these processes. I list a few here. I'm sure that folks could list more. But so there have been tremendous advances in characterization technologies. I have these photographs here, or graphs of a few. But, there's dozens and dozens of these new high-resolution technologies that have been developed over the last 10, 20 years, whatever, to the point now where we almost have so many technologies, we have a hard time deciding what's the optimum technology for our problem, our site. And we're back to the same old issues that we had with FRTR 30 years ago. Do we have the sort of performance and cost information that we need to promote these technologies? So I think FRTR continues to play a meaningful role in the technology transfer of these new characterization tools and data analysis methods. And that leads us to where we are today with our current initiatives. And I want to bring to everybody's attention once again that new FRTR fact sheet that pretty much describes what we've done in the last 30 years and what we're working on today. I've listed here on this slide number 6 some of the initiatives that FRTR is working on as we continue to focus on today's needs. Things like improving conceptual site models, ways to optimize remediation systems, starting to focus more and more on characterization and treatment technologies for emerging contaminants like PFAS, and so on down through here, and web-based strategies for improving technology transfer has been a big one with FRTR. In the last, say, 4, I don't know, 5 years, I can't remember, we've been doing a lot of FRTR presents webinars that follow our semi-annual meetings that provide our speakers with additional time to focus on particular topics that are, you know, presented in those semi-annual meetings. That's been very effective, and we've seen a steady growth in participation by people in federal agencies as well as state, local governments, private sector companies, just a slew of different types of people. We've seen a steady growth in participation in those webinars. That's a good thing to see. So we still have work to do on these issues. Well, where are we going? I think we've been useful. I think we have benefited. I think member agencies would agree that FRTR has been a benefit to them as a forum for collaboration and technology transfer. And as Dan described, I think ably, it's an organization that's contributed quite well to the success of advancing innovative technologies to into widespread use. That's become our focus here. But the problem is, of course, the challenges of remediation continue to evolve. And I list two here on the middle part of slide 7. And you know that it's, you know, one of them is related to the unique chemistry of PFAS, the chemical structure of the PFAS, and how that's changing the presenting new challenges to us in how to characterize and understand risk and attain effective treatment. Dan mentioned a couple of times, I think, in his presentation about the emerging challenge of assuring that our remedies are resilient. So I list that. So I think as we sit here today and look back at what we've done over 30 years and what we're doing right now in terms of some of these initiatives that Bobby and Mike Adam and Tom Nicholson talked about, it's an appropriate time to refresh our dialogue among federal agencies on what our challenges are and what our priorities are, and use that as a basis for translating those requirements into some collaborative initiatives that we can work on to improve our technology and to promote technology transfer. I skipped one. I'm sorry, guys. Where are we going? Maybe I didn't. Okay, my mistake. Well, that's our challenge for the coming year, really. And those preparations for 2021 start tomorrow. For the spring meeting, it'll start tomorrow when the steering committee gets together again and starts working toward the future. We're going to use the results of these polls the folks that have contributed to these polls, that's part of it. And we're going to engage. We don't know quite how yet because of the nature of whether we're going to be face-to-face or whether we're going to have to do something more in a virtual setting. But we want to engage senior leadership in our agencies. We've talked about that in the past. That's going to happen. We're going to try and engage our senior leadership in the agencies and our senior technical experts to help set those future priorities for FRTR. And ask basically, how can we be more useful to you? We certainly hope that by the time spring comes, we'll have face-to-face discussions. And if we have to do it virtually, we can figure it out. We're getting better and better and better at these virtual forums. It's amazing the skill level, how that's increased in the last 6 months. So the spring meeting is going to be a little different, you know, from our usual FRTR formats of presentations on technical topics. We're really going to try and emphasize panel discussions, work groups, so that we can have a back and forth and a real dialogue, and so we can come away from that meeting with a pretty good idea of perspectives that senior leadership will bring and senior technical experts will bring to that meeting. So I've listed here at the bottom of slide 8, I guess it is, a couple of goals right now for the spring meeting. But I've also talked about them, so I won't repeat. We need a lot of input from everybody that's on this webinar and anybody else. We want input from agency employees, but also stakeholders in the federal remediation programs. Contractors, that's regulators, a wide array of people. And why, of course, do we want to do that? Well, quite simply, we know that you guys in the audience, there are people that are struggling day to day with technology challenges. So we want to be relevant to your needs. So how do we get your input? This poll is part of it, these two polls, and you can see, I don't know, just glancing at them here, it's which of our current initiatives are you finding useful in your work? It's pretty strongly leaning toward techniques for improving conceptual site models and remedy optimization. I guess I'm glad to see that because we've made a real conscious effort to emphasize that in recent years in FRTR. As to what kinds of topics to address in the upcoming year or two or three, whatever, it's pretty broad, and there's not any one thing that sticks out. So, like I say, we'll take this. Please continue to give us your input. I think this will be up through the end of this seminar, and if you can't get, or if you have additional input, more specific, Gene's going to talk a little bit about a poll for, you know, when we close out this seminar here in a bit. But you know, give your input up through your leadership, you know, your management chain, if you will, because we are reaching out to these to our senior leadership, and it would be good if they came to the spring meeting armed with your ideas. You've seen a lot of emails of folks on the steering committee today on this webinar, so you know, shoot us an email, and that's another way to get a hold of us. So I think with that, I'm just about at the end of my time. I'm just going to leave you with what our vision will be for the spring and what we hope to accomplish at that spring meeting. I talked about it before, and this just sort of puts a stamp on it, and I hope to see you all maybe face-to-face, maybe virtually in spring meeting. Jean, back to you.
All right. Thank you so very much, Kent. I know we're just a little bit past our scheduled end time, but I do want to thank everybody who joined us for today's broadcast and shared their input and some of the questions that were posed by FRTR to our participants. I'm going to shift things around here on the screen and just walk through just a few quick final reminders before we close things out today. So please know that copies of the presentation materials are already available to download from the seminar homepage. So when you checked in for today's webinar, you would have gone through that clue-in page, and there's a tab on that page. There's a whole series of tabs with links to the description, the information about our presenters, links to download their slides, as well as a number of related resources. For those of you that are happening to be watching the recorded version of today's webinar, all of that content is also available right inside the recording. So again, on the middle right under related URLs, and I've been popping things in the Q&A. So those are all active hyperlinks. You can open those up. I would ask each of you to fill out that online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. There's also additional ways that you can provide input to the FRTR members as well about some thoughts that you have on future directions on that form. One of the most frequent questions I get is a request for a participation certificate. If you follow the link to the seminar feedback form and share feedback, as long as you check the box certifying you were here for the whole session, so that's available at the bottom of that form, as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then immediately have access to a participation certificate that will contain information about today's session along with links to where you can download the slides. So while we don't offer CEUs or PDHs, many times our attendees are able to get this participation certificate along with the meeting materials and still get credit for attending these sessions. If you happen to have multiple people join at your location, simply give those people the link to the feedback form and they can fill it out on their own, even if they didn't register individually, and get their own certificate. And so with that, I want to extend the deepest of thanks to everyone who participated in today's session. We had well over 230 people from all over the U.S., along with our presenters, our organizers, our agency representatives. We really do appreciate everybody hopping on, sharing their information, asking questions, and just interacting with each other virtually. So we'll go ahead and close out today's broadcast again, reminding you all that this session was recorded, and you'll automatically get an email as soon as the archived version is available for on-demand access. So with that, and one last thank you, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.